Hey, everybody, it's Mark Pattison, former NFL player, now climbing the seven summits, and welcome to another fantastic episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. Okay, look, 7-8 years ago, I had to step into the fear and put a big-ass goal out there, and so I decided to start climbing all these crazy mountains around the world. It's been an absolute amazing journey. And, you know, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I've actually done 6 of the 7. I've actually been on Denali twice. I've been on climb successfully, Kilimanjaro twice. But now it's Mount Everest, the biggest boy on the block, 29,000 plus. And I'm headed over there April 2020. And I'm totally keyed up. And I'm keyed up because I've been doing all this preparation. I train like an absolute bear. And, really putting myself in a position of success. I'm going to be climbing with one of the top climbing outfitters in the world. Excited about that. And just the mountain has fascinated me for years, I'm sure like others, but really excited to do so. And so if I can actually pull this thing off, I'd be the first NFL player to do so. And so as we speak today, there's not that many first in the world. So I look forward to tackling that. Okay, so that's one. Two is I totally appreciate the listen on these different podcasts. I really do. And it's been an amazing journey, as I said, from not just interviewing these people, but being on the other side of the mic and really taking in their incredible stories of doing amazing things. And look, we all need to be inspired. And so if I can help provide and find more people that meet that criteria, all the better. And it just, we all need that motivation, and we all need that those words of encouragement that you can make it back relevant to your own situation and then plow forward in whatever endeavor you are trying to do. Okay, so I appreciate that. And if you want to find out anything that I have going on, you can do so at markpattisonnfl.com. I've got a book out now called Finding Your Summit, go figure. And it is essentially the playbook to what I had learned from my Hall of Fame coaches on how to emerge and do some great things in your life. It doesn't have to be mountain climbing, of course. It can be anything, but it's a plug-in that you take on these different things, these different goals, that these different strategies that I've set forth, that they set forth for me. And good things can come from that. Okay. Also on the website, you can find out more about my expedition. Obviously, I'll be going to Mount Everest, and we'll have more information about that coming up. There's an e-learning course and, of course, the podcast. And when you go to the podcast, you will find an iTunes tab. And I would be so grateful if you go in and you'd rate and review. Now, it all has to do with visibility, popularity of podcasts, because there's so many podcasts out there today that it's so easy to get lost and like, wait, where's Finding Your Summit? And I think I really do believe these stories are really amazing and incredible and can really give a lift to those people who really need it. And even if you don't, we all need to be motivated and inspired by other people to keep going. So if you'd go in and do that, I would be really, really appreciative. Okay, so let's go listen to the pod. It's going to be awesome. Here we go.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark. I'm back again with another epic episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And I continue to have a string of guests that I'm totally jacked up about because it fits within the circle of friends, extended friends that I've come to know through the climbing community. This guy, his name is Alan Arnett. Alan has become, seems like, the spokesperson for all these recent tragedies on Mount Everest. He's been climbing for a number of years. He's committed to trying to solve Alzheimer's one of these days. He's put a lot of effort behind that. He's been on K2. He's been on Everest. He's been on all the 58 Colorado mountains, 14,000 and over. So totally jacked to have Alan on the pod. Alan, how you doing?
Doing great, Mark. Hey, I really appreciate you inviting me. It's a real honor.
Well, it's an honor back. You know, I in kind of a strange twist, how I found out about you is, you know, when we do share this tie in climbing mountains and crazy mountains around the world, but more importantly and tragically, this mess that's been going on at Mount Everest. And you know, since I have been on the mountain many of these same mountains that you have been on. I'm about to take on Everest this next spring in 2020. I've not climbed K2. I don't know where I fall on that one, but I can tell you this, that in January 2019 now, I was in Antarctica. And of course, as you know, because you've climbed it, there's a mountain down there called Vincent Massif. And we had a climbing party of about 10. And one of the guys in that climbing party was a guy by the name of Don Cash. And Don Cash, as you know, because you reported on it through many of these different news outlets, was a guy from Salt Lake City, Utah. He was my tent mate. And coming out of that trip, I predicted that something tragic would most likely happen to him. A year ago, as of tomorrow, we're talking today on June 6th, 2019, June 7th, 2018, I take the top of Denali, and he was there 3 days before me. I did not know him at that time, but he did lose three fingers and frostbite on his nose and toes and everything else. And, you know, it's just at the end of the day, and this is, I guess, kind of where we'll start, but there's just some people that shouldn't be in the mountains, and you should really know your strengths and weaknesses. And I don't believe that he was truly aware what his were.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I don't like to speak ill of anybody.
Yep.
You know, what's interesting though is that when I summited Vincent in late 2010, December, my tent mate was a gentleman named Rick Hitch, and we both ended up on Everest 6 months later, and Rick fell over dead on the fixed ropes right below Camp 3. Hmm. And Rick was very, very skilled. He was experienced, but it shows you the randomness of altitude and the randomness of what mountains do to people. And, you know, I have this firm philosophy that mountains are for everybody, and that everybody should be given the opportunity and not prevented from being able to go on a mountain. And, not but, and they need to earn the right, not just to pay the money and then be put on the mountain. And what we've seen this year, out of the 11 deaths, I estimate that maybe 7 of those deaths were related to some level of inexperience. Now, you can overcome that to some extent by the level of support that you get. And this has been a little line I've been using for close to 5 years now on Everest, is that you've got inexperienced climbers with inadequate support or unqualified guides. You take those two characteristics and you put them onto a pressure-cooked, overcrowded day with the weather moving in on both sides. It's a recipe for disaster, and that's what we saw this year.
Yeah, I want to clarify my statement because I think it overlaps with what you just said. I love what you just said about earning your way. And I think, Don, first of all, let's clear this up. Great family man, phenomenal guy. But the reason why I'm bringing this kind of the front of the pod is because, not to say as his character, there's anything wrong with it, that he's bad. He's a man of tremendous character and tremendous integrity. It's really more about, like, somebody's got to, like, let me back up. So there was a chat, right, on within the group of the Vincent, and everybody knew it. Even Alpine Ascents knew this, and they were going to charge him an extra 10 grand to have an extra guide come down. Now, at the last minute, it didn't play out that way, and I ended up guiding one of the ropes. But there was clearly a disconnect, and one of the climbers in this chat post all this mess happening said, I wish somebody would have stood up and said something. Like, say, and so maybe that falls back into now, yeah. Hey, it's too early. You got to earn it. You got to climb more mountains. You know, there's a lot of places you can go in Colorado and other places around the world, to your point, where you can work your way up in a way that you're better prepared when things go south. And then he wasn't with probably one of the top, this is another point I think you brought up, operator that was more of a low cost run group that I don't think they had the proper skills in terms of being a guide, the difference between a guide and a Sherpa. And you've been on these mountains a lot, and you can probably do a better job of articulating the difference between what a guide is and what a Sherpa is. And sometimes they cross over, but there's two differences.
Yeah, it's a total Venn diagram, and it varies, you know, according to, you know, who the Sherpa is and who the Western guide is. But, you know, there's several attributes, I think, that come into play with any. And I'm getting to the point now where I'm more calling it support and trying to not use inflammatory terms like, you know, Western guide or Sherpa guide. I love it. Nepal renamed all, everybody whose last name is Sherpa became a Sherpa guide 3 years ago. Because there was this controversy that there weren't enough guides in the mountain. And they also put in a rule that said that everybody had to hire a guide. So they just renamed every Sherpa, Sherpa guide. So that's like saying that everybody on an airplane is a pilot.
Yeah.
You know, just because you have the last name of Sherpa,
yeah.
With all due respect to all the Sherpas that are fantastic out there. And I've got a, what I call my Nepal family is the Sherpa that I summited Everest and K2 and other peaks with around the world. And I love them dearly.
But what you're really talking about, and keep going here, I just want to
assert
this, but what you're not saying anything derogatory, you're just saying the word really qualified.
Right.
That's the word that needs to be plugged in there.
Exactly. And so, you know, I look at things like medical training. You know, does the person that is with me, do they understand what the early signs of altitude sickness is, pulmonary, cerebral edema, or just, you know, generic AMS type of things? If they do able to, if they are able to recognize it, do they know what to do? Can they treat it? Which obviously the only treatment is to get down, to go down immediately. That takes me to the second thing. And I'm putting off to the side the entire subject of, are they qualified to climb the mountain?
Yeah.
You know, because most of these people, they're able to follow a fixed rope up with a Jumar on Everest. Yeah. You know, Everest is really not about climbing. It's really about high altitude hiking. But that altitude is the kicker. And so if you can't handle that, then you're not going to be able to climb Everest. It's not like you've got to do dual ice axes over your head. And, you know, you don't have to be Alex Honnold to climb Everest, right? So then you get into the interpersonal skills. And I was just telling somebody earlier today that my first time on Everest was 2002. I was at 27,300 feet, right below the balcony. I was on my hands and knees, gagging, vomiting. I thought I was going to cough up a liver or something. And I knew that I was done. 7 hours into it. So I was with a young Sherpa. This is his first time on Everest. And I was with a world-class company that I won't name because they were early in their organizational development. And so I looked at my young Sherpa and I said, I'm going down. He said, yes, up. So I turned around, Mark, on my own, by myself, and went back down to the South Col and then on down to Camp 3. And when the owner of the company found out about that, I mean, he coughed up a liver because he just got so upset that one of his customers was basically allowed to randomly wander around 8,000 meters. And he made a lot of major changes as a result of that. But my point is that my young Sherpa friend, he lacked the interpersonal communication, not only the communication talent or a capability, but he lacked the interpersonal skills to be able to help me when I needed the most. And this year, we've got story after story of where a person was in trouble and the Sherpa said, you've got to turn around. You're going too slow. And the client said, no, I paid too much money. I'm going up here no matter what. That's where all of a sudden you separate between being a Sherpa or being a companion to being a professional mountain guide that has the skills, the vocabulary, the interpersonal strengths to be able to say, no, you're going down. I'm not going to abandon you. You're going down with me right now. And that's a tough, tough gig.
So let's talk about your gig. And again, I think when we start talking about, we all go through adversity and adversity has different levels, right? And I think for me, at least, climbing mountains has really been a test, and a test of will, a test of strength, a test of grit, a test of nutrition, a test of, and along the way, you know, I didn't, you know, my first mountain many years ago, when I was down in on Kilimanjaro, I was sailing along, everything was going great, and then we get to final summit day, and I fly out, and I'm way in front of everybody, and all of a sudden I just crashed, you know, and so it was really a lesson for me in nutrition and hydrating, and then there's been other lessons in terms of equipment failures. You know, I was on Rainier and didn't have the right stuff, and you know, I made it through. But for you, speaking specifically now about Everest, it took you 4 tries to make that thing happen. And so I'm curious, you know, you just obviously, you know, your 4th time you powered through, and I'm interested in hearing that. But I'm also, you know, when you start talking about there's kind of, I think there's 2 parts of it. We all have great ambitions. The people that want to go climb a big mountain like Mount Everest, like I'm doing this next year. And in my mind right now, I've got nothing but I'm going to summit this thing, right? And that's what you have to go into. And in your case, on that particular trip, your body just wouldn't allow you to continue to propel yourself up the mountain. So you did the right thing and you turn around and come back. So now you get into, now you're back at home, you're back in Fort Collins, Colorado, and you're thinking about, okay, I want to go do this because I didn't meet my goal, all this kind of stuff. And as it would play out, you would go again and didn't make it. You'd go again and you didn't make it. So I'm interested in like what was going on. And at the same time, this isn't like going down to the local McDonald's and ordering a Happy Meal, right? I mean, it costs a lot of flipping money to make these things happen. So tell me kind of what happened, what's the chronological story of what was going through your mind, what happened in those moments. And then ultimately on that fourth summit, you know, you actually did make it.
So I always tell people before you try Everest, I highly recommend that you go to another 8,000 meter mountain to understand how your body performs at altitude so that you know what you know. Yeah. And that's one of the issues going on right now on Everest is people, they're up there, they don't know what they don't know. And so, and then they're with people that they don't know how to interact with you. So that's that deadly combination I'm going to come back to over and over and over again. For me, I had climbed Choyoyu in Tibet. And is 8,207 meters, no, 26,907. So it's a little over 8,000 meters. And I got up to the summit plateau and it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon and we hit our turnaround time. So I went down and if I had known then what I know now, I would have gone ahead and pushed myself and gotten to the true summit. But I also understood how my body reacted. So when I'm at 27,300 feet on Everest in 2002, I know I am at the I knew I could take another step higher. I didn't know if I could get back down alive. And I care too much about my family and myself in, you know, to do that. So I came home. I was pretty defeated. I mean, it was an emotional experience. So then I went back a year later, you know, and I got to exactly the same point. There's a big rock where you make a right-hand turn to go up to the balcony. And I call it my big favorite rock. You can substitute whatever F word you like. And so I got back up the next year and basically, you know, Mark, I had this little saying, I'd say a failure is when you attempt something really hard, you don't accomplish your objective and you don't learn anything from it. So a failure is when you don't learn. And so you can say in some ways, my 2002 effort was a failure because I repeated exactly the same thing. The definition of insanity, 2003. Came back home again, tail between the legs. I'm done with this stuff. So, but then I there was something about the mountaineering and the big mountains. So I went back. I tried Broad Peak and Shishapangma over the next few years. Didn't make the summit of those, but they were all positive experiences. So then in 2008, a year before, my mom Ida had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And by that time, I had a pretty good following with my website, and I was absolutely committed that I was not going to let my mother's disease at the time just become another statistic. So I went back in 2008 in using the climb as a way to raise awareness. And this one was probably the most difficult, meaningful educational experiences of my, perhaps my life. I got up to my big favorite rock. And I was going slow again, 7 hours, should have been three. And I got up there, it's perfectly clear night, no wind. And I was just, my energy was just like being sucked out of me. And I stood there and I stepped off the fixed rope to let people, I was holding people up. So I stepped off on a safe side with the Sherpa Lam Babu, very well-respected, excellent, excellent Sherpa. And I looked at Lam and I said, Lam, I'm tired. He goes, I know. I sat there and I watched 40 people. It's like counting sheep going to sleep. I watched 40 people go by. And each time my self-confidence went down, my belief in myself went down. And I did a couple of take a step higher, take a step lower, higher, lower, higher, lower. And finally, I just said, remember what a friend of mine once told me. He said, when you know the right thing to do, do it. And I turned around and started heading back down. And I got back down to base camp. I gave away my $1,000 suit, my $1,000 sat phone, everything. Wow. Just like the alcoholic the next morning says, I'm never going to drink again. I'm never going to climb again. I'm done with this shit. Came home totally defeated. So then I spent the next few years with Ida, overseeing her care and being with her and watching how she never lost her sense of humor, her resiliency, just her grace and how she handled this disease. And so I decided I wanted to go do the seven summits, including Everest again. And I got a sponsor in Johnson & Johnson to help talk about Alzheimer's. And we decided we wanted to do it in under a year. So now fast forward to May 20th, 2011. I'm with Kami Sherpa. We're up to my big favorite rock now in 2.5 hours, not seven. And kept on going. And I get in the middle of the Southeast Ridge. And all of a sudden I get that deja vu feeling of losing energy.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, oh God, come on, Alan. You can't not do it this time. And I often talk about that there's 1,000 reasons to turn around, 1,000 reasons to quit, and only one to keep going.
Yeah.
And I think in my previous times, I had focused on the one reason I couldn't do it, or the 1,000 reasons I couldn't do it. And this time I was thinking about honoring my mom, my five aunts who have also died from Alzheimer's, the 5 million in the U.S., 50 million around the world, their caregivers, the researchers. And I just got this extra sense of urgency and strength. And we powered through and made the summit in 7 hours from the South Col. And being on that summit was a moment. It was a moment.
Hey, this pod is sponsored by Laird Superfoods. So many products to choose from your InstaFuel, your coffee, your tea, your smoothies. And I love the Superfood Creamer and use the hydration powders like the beets, the coconut, the matcha, the turmeric to mix all into my 7 Summit smoothie. And it's so good. Log on to LairdSuperfood.com and get your 20% off when you use the code MARKP20. Okay? So get your Laird Superfood, and I guarantee it will help fuel your journey.
Yeah, that's incredible. You know, we all have our, I think everybody as an individual has to hold on to what is meaningful to them to help them get through these tough circumstances. Yeah. I think one of the things for me that really helped out was my training, my background. Mm-hmm. These hard-ass coaches that I played for in college at the University of Washington and in the NFL, right? And so one of those things that they taught me was about you know, pain is temporary. And this has happened to me numerous times when I've gone up on these different mountains, and I'm fairly strong. But I also have my moments, right? And my moments, like I said before, where I've crashed. And I'm just like, and I've learned little techniques that have helped me get stronger in this, probably this last mountain on Vincent. I was probably, in terms of beginning to end and back, you know, I probably felt the best. And that had to do with a bunch of different things. But, you know, you learn these things over time. And one of the things that keeps coming back in my mind always is that when I'm on that place, because we all have that little voice inside. It's not just, we're not just, you know, a guy with a cape on and you know, everything is green lighted, right? You have these moments and that little voice inside your head, you know, you can't do it. You can't. And that's what you're talking about. That's what you're going through. And I always think about that moment that when you finally call it and you go back, and sometimes there's no other choice. It happened to me on Denali in 2017. But when you do have a choice and it's not life-threatening, it's I think about the pain is temporary comment about trying to power through. And that memory that I have to live with the rest of my life, if I don't accomplish this because I quit, I gave up. You know, you said it perfectly. Those 1,000 little things that you can come up in your mind that you know, like, go get a hot shower, go get a warm meal. You know, all the stuff that you want to go do. Yet, if you can just power through, 24 hours later, you're sitting in Kathmandu drinking a beer, and life is great if you can pull that off, right? And so, I mean, again, I think it's just not my way. It's not just your way. I think everybody has to really understand and process through what that thing in their life, maybe it's not mountain climbing, maybe it's a disease, right? To get them through that.
Yeah. You know, the infamous why question always comes up, especially after seasons like this, is why in the world would you climb Everest? And, you know, I've had a lot of journalists ask me this over the last 10 days. And I got into almost an argument on live radio with the BBC. It was a good British BBC interviewer. And he was like, so why in the world would people want to go climb these mountains? They're going to die. They're going to put other people in danger too. And I said, you know, I said, well, climbing, the reason is very unique and personal to each individual. And in general, climbing is not a spectator sport where you're trying to accomplish it for the team or for fame and fortune or rewards. It's unique and personal. everybody has their own reason, and I try not to judge what anybody's reason is for wanting to be there. But, and it's also critical that you know why you're there, because that's the reason that you focus on, that when you do hit mile 23 in the marathon, you don't just hit up, you know, you just don't give up. When you hit that wall, no matter what your sport is, you know, you're behind by two and with 2 minutes to go in the game, right? You don't give up, you double down, but you know why you're there. And climbing is a very interesting sport. I mean, it's something that, yeah, there are people that do it for theoretical fame and fortune, but I think most people just do it for the challenge and for the personal satisfaction of trying to accomplish a difficult goal. I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, elevation 300 feet. What's this Memphis boy doing on the summit of Everest? What's he doing being the oldest American at age 58 to summit K2 on his birthday? I mean, do you think I ever thought about that as a 12-year-old in Memphis, Tennessee, on the banks of the Mississippi River? No.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a bunch of stuff that's packed in there. And for sure, you know, you're talking about your mom, Ida, and about this Alzheimer's situation that she had that you had to endure. I mean, she had to endure it too. But then as the other end of that, when she's not recognizing you as her son, and those painful moments, and then ultimately she passes away. John Wooden had this, you know, his pyramid of success at the very top of that triangle. It's competitive greatness. And so really, what does that mean? Right. So we all want to say we have competitive greatness.
Yeah.
And what that means is that, you are at your best when your best is required. But then you break that down. So that's another easy thing to say, like, hey, I'm going to be at my best. But really what that means to me is that you're really talking about that. It's preparation meets opportunity. So then what does that mean? So you break that down a little bit further. And this is, I think, also driven with why, because this plays into it too. It's just not about climbing the top of the highest mountains in the world. Like Mount Everest, you have a strong why. And this is just my answer, right? It doesn't have to be your answer.
Yeah.
But I think you have to love process. And I can honestly say that since I was a little kid, that every single day I go out and I run in the mountains. I'm here in Sun Valley. And I'm up and down. There's no lights. There's no camera. There's no CNN. You know, there's none of that stuff. And I love that. And so ultimately, just when I was playing football in college, you know, it took me 3-4 years before I got in the field. But I practiced, watch film. And I did all this with no certainty. Just like you, when you were climbing these different crazy mountains around the world, you did so without certainty that you're going to reach the top. And in fact, you didn't, right?
Right.
Ultimately, you did. But it took that moment, and that's so. It's, you know, I think it's a strong why. I think it's competitive greatness. I think it's a process. I think you have to love those different things, and then you get into this whole thing over here, which we started the conversation today, which is about inexperience and plays into in this perfect storm that you mentioned, where you put all these factors together, and then it becomes very explosive.
Right, right. And this year, I'm not sure that there were people on the mountain that knew why they were there. And I think that's critical. You know, I had this business called Summit Coach, where I take people and I don't, you know, I'm not a guide. I don't sell any gear, but I offer a consulting service. And my typical client is someone in their middle 30s, maybe early 40s, that says, you know, I want to go climb something, a big mountain, probably an 8,000 meter mountain. Some are very clear they want to do 7 summits or, and so I coach them through that whole process, from guides to gear to training to expectations, the whole bit. But in that first call, we spend a good solid half an hour on the why. And I get to play the 2-year-old. Hey, Dad, why is the sky blue? Well, because, well, why is that? Why is that? So no matter what answer they give me, and I'm upfront with it, I tell them in the very beginning that I'm going to be a real pain here for the next half an hour because I want to hear from you what's the why. Because when you hit mile 23, I want you to reflect on this conversation. And I just had two clients summit Everest, one from the north, one from the south this year. And one of them sent me a note halfway through saying, I don't know if I can do this. And I just went back and I just said, why, with a question mark. And that got him back on track. You got to know why. You got to know why you're up at 5 o'clock in the morning running up and down a mountain in the dark when you can twist your ankle and whatever. You got to know why when you're going to do that climb and try to see if you can't get 2,000 feet an hour on a 14,000 foot mountain. Because this stuff hurts. I mean, it hurts. It's hard. I don't care what people say about Everest. It is damn hard. And when you're up at 27,000, 28,000 feet, and lines or no lines, when I summited, I was the fourth person on May 21st at 5 a.m. to stand on the summit. It was Miriam, my teammate, her Sherpa, Basang, me, and Kami. And it was not the most important day in my life. It was not the most meaningful day in my life, but it was in the top on both of those categories.
I'm sure. Huge accomplishment. So another thing that you talk about, and I want to tie this back to a mountain that you did on your birthday, your 58th birthday, you're talking about purpose and passion.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, this is, you know, we're talking about K2 now because, I mean, if there was ever a strong why, there would be a strong why, like all caps. And, you know, there's purpose and passion goes probably to a lot of things you've done. And I want to get into that in a minute, but I want to start with K2. I'm fascinated with that mountain, like a lot of people are. I don't know if that means for me, I'm going to go climb it. But, you know, it's in Pakistan and you go through that and that's just like a whole adventure in its own of like, can you even get into Pakistan and out safe, you know, without being shot as an American? And then as I'm told from Vesters and some other guys that mountain is pretty much straight up. And a guy that I talked to, he's been on the podcast I'm talking to after this call, is Garrett Madison. And I know he's done it a couple different times. I'm sure you know Garrett. So tell me about your why around the mountain K2, where certainly the mortality rate of something negative happening to you is way, 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 way higher than, say, a mountain like Mount Everest.
Yeah. So again, going back to my Memphis roots, this wasn't even on the bookshelf. And so I had done Everest and Ida had passed away in 2009. So now this is 2011. I did Everest and then I did Manaslu, another 8,000 meter mountain in 13. So I back in the autumn of that and I'm thinking, okay, so what's next? And I would have been comfortable giving up the high altitude stuff. At this point, I'm 57 years old. I got 2 8,000 meter mountains under my belt and a handful of others I attempted, you know, so it's been a good game.
Yeah.
And then I started thinking, you know, Alzheimer's arguably is the world's hardest disease to try to crack. I mean, there's other ones that are equally horrible and never get in that competition. But Alzheimer's, you know, there's no cure. There's no real solid ways of diagnosis. Once you get it, it's 100% fatal. You can't slow it down, stop it, reverse it. It's a tough disease, and they call it the long goodbye. So I was thinking, well, what would be the toughest mountain that would be analogous to the toughest disease?
Hmm.
So I get this call from a PR company in Austin, Texas, that says, hey, Alan, I saw on your website, yada, yada, yada. I was wondering, we have a client that we want to sponsor somebody to go climb Everest. And I said, well, what about K2? And this lady understood mountaineering. She goes, oh, that'd be great. And I said, well, how about me? And she goes, really? So just through a confluence of random events, wow, the opportunity presented itself to me. And I've got another, as you now are getting to understand, I have all these little sayings. And one of them is, when a window opens up in your life, you have an obligation to jump through that window head first without regard of where you're going to land. And so I jumped through that window and I started to plan my own trip with a small company. And then I got a call from Garrett Madison, who said, hey, Alan, I'm planning my first trip to K2. I understand you're looking also. How about if we join forces? He goes, you know, I said, well, is this a commercial trip? And he goes, well, kind of more or less, but we're going to have some Sherpas, but this is my first trip there. I want to go figure it out. So I said, well, I'll go with you only if I can get Kami, the Sherpa I summited Everest with. So lo and behold, is Garrett and Matt Dupree from California and myself, with 3 Sherpas, including Connie Rita Sherpa, who just set the record for the 24th summit of Everest. And
awesome.
Furkacha is the other 3rd Sherpa. And Beasters is 100% right. The difference between Everest and K2 is that K2 goes straight up. There's never any relief whatsoever. And you've got rock fall. Furkacha got hit in the arm with a rock. Kami got hit the next year, dislocated his shoulder, almost killed him on K2. And it's a long story about my K2 experience, but suffice it to say, that was another major milestone summiting on my 58th birthday. And we didn't even know that was going to be a record. And I think I was the, I'm going to get that wrong. I won't even quote it. Yeah. So, but all 3 of us, you know, we were some of the early Americans that have done it. And I think I was the 16th American and Garrett was the 14th American. But, you know, Garrett ran a first-class trip, and it was really, really rewarding and hard.
Yeah. And when you're on that mountain, are you feeling the danger at all times with the steepness?
Yeah. There's always rock fall. There's a rock whizzing by your head. This past year, teams where they watched this poor Canadian guide, very well experienced. They watched his body tumble down between camp two and camp three. He lost his purchase. Yeah. 25%. So 1 in 4 of the people that attempt K2 die.
Yeah.
Well, on Everest is 4%. So,
yeah.
And I always tell people, they say, hey, I want to go do K2. My first question, other than the why, actually, my first question with K2 is, are you prepared to die?
Well, look, it's a fascinating mountain. It's out there, and you know, we all have choices on what we want to do. And for me, it's an old football analogy was always one game at a time, and I really try to focus on that. So 100% of my focus is 100% on Mount Everest, and that's going to be a big enough challenge, you know, and it's on its own. So,
well, Everest will give you the altitude experience, and you absolutely need that to see how your body performs at, you know, at 8,900 feet, 8,850, compared to only 800 feet lower on K2. But I bet you that you'll do great on Everest because you've got the entire makeup that it takes to do well on that mountain. And depending upon who you go with, you'll have great support. And K2 is an absolutely worthy mountain of attempting, and really low percentage of people that make it though.
So let me ask you this. So you're you've been dropping in all these different mountains, and I had mentioned that you've done all these mountains in Colorado and K2 and Everest a bunch of times, and Choi Yu and these other ones. And so as we talk about life, balance, work, play, I'm not sure. I just made those up, but really that it becomes like, there's a lot of people I get messages, you know, quite a bit like, gosh, one day I'd love to do that if I just had the money, and you know, how that all works. But were you had a former life working for HP. Did you shut that down, or were you just able to work for that company while you were climbing these mountains around the world? And that's just something that they allowed you to do.
How do I give you a short answer for this? You know, you talked about earlier, I think you said Vince Lombardi had a triangle that he talked about.
Well, it was Coach Wooden, John Wooden.
John Wooden, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's very interesting because I have a triangle as well. And my triangle is an equilateral triangle where it's work, family, and myself. And I've always found I'm the happiest in my life at a moment in life where it is an equilateral triangle. I have balance across all three of those areas, work, family, and myself. And when I get out of whack, when I'm spending way too much time on work, which I did for the first 20 years of my career with HP, and everything else suffers, as my ex-wife would tell you. So, and I did nothing for myself. And make a real long story, very, very short, I was in Geneva, Switzerland, running this huge organization. And somebody walked into my office in late July and said, hey, I'll see you in September. I said, wait a minute, what? So what about August? You go, oh, that's right, you're an American. So in Europe, we take August off in order to recharge and spend our time with family and to pursue our own interest. And he turned it on his heels and walked away. Well, I got to thinking about that, and I realized for the last 20 years that I never took August off.
Yeah.
Or July or January.
Well, a typical American, right?
Typical American.
Yeah.
So that became an inflection point, and I shifted over, and I actually took a trek to Everest Base Camp in 97 as a result of that. And that's what started this crazy addiction that I still have today of climbing mountains. So.
Well, that's awesome. And that's the way to do it. And I think, you know, when you start talking about, you know, your family, your work, and your play, and however you phrase that, you know, we're constantly, I mean, I think like on paper, that's easy to write down, right? And then constantly things in life happen that put you out of whack and put you out of kilter, and you ended up, you know, being too far over here or too far over there. And I mean, look, I am the casualty too of now having an ex-wife and all that, and probably to my fault, I probably, you know, I had these companies I was running and I was going too hardcore, and just a lot of my time and energy went towards that. But also I was supporting a lifestyle, you know, where somebody didn't have to work and the kids were going to private schools, and you know, you just have these, you know, the golden handcuffs or whatever you want to call them that propel you kind of in that direction. And then when you're wired to do certain things in certain ways, it's just hard to like dial that back. And so scar tissue for sure, learning kind of new ways. And that's, yeah, you know, for me, moving to Sun Valley, that's a big one. Climbing mountains around the world and having that time out, which is a big one. Being more present, that's been a big one for me. But, you know, we all have our different things that pull us out of whack. And the question is really how you get back in line. And maybe for you, it's having that solitude in the mountains. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, well, definitely, you know, that being in the mountains, it absolutely renews my soul. It feeds my essence. If I don't get up in the mountains for a while, like I've been sitting here in my office for the last 2 months following Everest 7x24, and yeah, I finally was able to get out the last 2 days and get up to, you know, to 14,000 feet here in Colorado. And today I feel on top of the world. So I'm, and you know, but you're right. Situationally, every now and then that triangle just breaks down, and you know, you have to do what you have to do. You know, sometimes you just got to work your butt off. Other times you've got to support your family in taking time off from work. And most importantly, you need to take care of yourself. You know, it's the rule of being like search and rescue. Don't become the victim. That you're there to help somebody, but don't do something that's going to put yourself in danger. Just like being a caregiver with somebody with Alzheimer's or another disease, you've got to take time for yourself. And I'm a firm believer that you have to invest in yourself if you're going to have the ability to be a great employee, to be a great spouse, to be a great father. You've got to invest in yourself. And that's where that balance comes into play. And one final comment about that, Mark, is that also this plays into self-awareness when you're on the mountain. You know, when you're on Denali, you know, when I was on K2 or on the early Everest and I had hit that wall or something happened, and, you know, having the self-awareness that, and again, another one of my sayings is, are you hurt or are you hurting? You know, I broke my leg a couple of years ago on a mountain. I was hurt. I broke my tibia and fibula in three places. I was hurt. Now, when I was on, you know, when I was on Everest in 2011 at 28,500 feet below the South Summit, I was hurting. And so there's a difference of being able to push through versus getting help. I was, yeah, had a broken leg on an 11,000 foot mountain. I needed help. And 40 people from search and rescue came and dragged my sorry ass down a windy mountain at midnight. And, you know, on Everest on that Thursday morning, I was just able to push through because I knew I wasn't hurt, but I just was now fighting the psychological game. The physical game would have been won. It was the psychological game. And knowing that difference and having that perspective and that sense of purpose. You talked about purpose and passion. I am unbelievably fortunate at age 62 to have that intersection in my life of purpose, of being an Alzheimer's advocate, and passion of climbing mountains. And I never dreamed my life would be at this point, you know, 20, 30 years ago. But today, I'm just eternally grateful for what I have.
Hey, I'm excited to introduce our new partner of the pod, Cascade Mountain Tech, an outdoor brand from the Pacific Northwest, which is where I'm from, that offers a great selection of trekking poles. They're incredible. Super coolers, camp chairs, LED lighting, and much more. Right now, Cascade Mountain Tech is offering 15% off your first order by using the code FINDINGYOURSUMMIT15, that is, FINDINGYOURSUMMIT15, when you check out at CascadeMountainTech.com.
Yeah, same here. It's really been incredible. I've said this numerous times on the pod, which is the blessings that I have received by stepping into the fear and going after this big goal. And, you know, I would say, I don't know where it is on the list, but it's not number one, and that is taking the top. You know, obviously that's the ultimate goal, but it's really going around the world, seeing different cultures, experiencing different teammates.
Yeah,
having to go through your adversities, figuring it out, getting close. You know, there's a whole lot of things. And from that, you know, here comes the pod, right? Which has been super cool. Okay, so taking just a slight shift, I noticed that you've, as I mentioned before, that you've climbed all of Colorado's 58 peaks that are over 14,000. Now, there's one that I'm really interested in climbing that I'm going to fly out to Colorado and I want you to take me on. And I saw this on a video, on a YouTube video, and I'm going to say this the wrong name, but it might help describe, but it's one of the more probably edgy ones that I've seen of danger. And going towards the final summit, it's almost like a shark's fin or something, right? That you have to go across these rocks and you're almost like, you know, you're not even, I don't even think I saw the guy that was walking on it. He was like, straddling this thing as he's trying to make his way across this like ridge high up over 14,000 feet.
What, do you know the name of it?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I have to do more research, but if there's one that seemed pretty hairy more than the others that you're going across on a saddle at, you know, 1,000 feet on either side.
It sounds like you're talking about Capitol Peak, because there's something called the Knife Edge.
The Knife Edge, there you go.
Yeah, so it's actually about 600 feet below this summit, but it's the troll on the route that you have to pay to get across. Okay. And most people do just bite their bite their pride and just straddle that sucker and just kind of inch across.
Yeah.
And yeah, but I've also seen people. I saw this one guy a few years ago that did it, and this guy just tight roped across it. Really tall, thin, lanky guy. Probably, you know, did the zip line stuff and tight roped and a slack line. But this guy just walked across it, and all of us were just like, we were totally put to shame. But Capitol is it's actually my second most favorite of the 14ers. Long's Peak is my favorite because it's only an hour and a half from here to walking up the mountain from where I live. And but Capitol is a good 6-hour backpack to get in into the backcountry or in this wow. basin. If you go towards the end of the summer, you get the wildflowers that are just all over the place. You know, it's an alpine start. You get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and work your way through this boulder field and up into the sub peak is called K2 of all things. Mm. And I always love it. People go, yeah, some do K2. It's like, wait a minute, that's a 12,000 foot bump on Capitol. And then you go across that knife edge and then it's a serious, serious climb to get up to the summit. But it's
one of the
most fulfilling ones.
Yeah, no, and that's why I saw it. I was like, wow, I got to go do this. What is the highest mountain in Colorado?
Albert, at 14, what is it, Albert? 14,265, something like that. Okay. And it's a big bump. It's a big bump, but it's a fun climb for walking.
Yeah, I didn't realize this, and some other guy had this on his bucket list, but to climb the highest mountain in every state. And so
yeah, high pointers.
The high pointers, yeah. And I didn't realize I'd actually done four of the hardest ones.
Yeah.
Bora here in Idaho, Whitney. Rainier, and of course Denali, and that's Denali obviously is the one that most people get hung up on, but yeah. You know, what a great way to see the U.S. And you know going back to your comment that you had in probably minute three here about I think everybody should be able to climb in the mountains. Now then you start to define, you know, what that means. Yeah. And working your way up in terms of experience, but it's such a great way and a great outlet and a great way to really get clear on where you want to go in your life, what's going on with you now. And you know, mountains like that, or you know, you go down to, you mentioned you grew up in Tennessee, and so that's 352 feet or whatever you said it is. You know, that's open the door and tap your toe, right. And then go see the Elvis Museum. You know, what a great way to see the state, right?
Yep. Yeah, the 50 high pointers. There's something like 300 people that have done all true 50, including Mauna Kea in Hawaii. You know, and then there's a Gannett Peak in Wyoming. That's a difficult one. You got to backpack into that one or get llamas to bring in your gear. And you've got it's technical. It's a small glacier on this summit that you have to get to. Yeah. Then you got the ones in Alabama, Mississippi, and Florida, which are, you can drive to each one of them and knock them all off in an afternoon.
Yeah.
Then you got like Mount Washington in New Hampshire, which is a real SOB. Yeah. I did that one a few years ago in December, got my butt totally kicked, you know, by the wind and the snow and whiteouts.
It's brutal.
So yeah, the people that do it now, there's all these people trying to do races and see who can do it the fastest. Some guy, I don't know, he was sponsored and had access to a private jet and flew from place to place. And he did all 50 in, you know, something ridiculous, like 3 days or something.
Yeah. That was Colin O'Brady. He's been on the pod. Yeah. No, he's got some crazy stuff going on. So let me ask you this. You're 62, you've had all these wonderful accomplishments. You're kind of seen as an authority in terms of when tragedy, yeah, unfortunately speaks, or, you know, what's your opinion on the way of the world as it relates to mountain climbing, these different networks give you a call. But as you, in terms of your own personal goals and aspirations, you know, where do you go from here?
Yeah, that's that is the $64 question. There's a saying, I was told it was originally applied to pilots, but I think it applies to mountaineering as well, is that there's old climbers and bold climbers, but no old bold climbers.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure Alex Honnold considers this on whatever his next project is going to be, because he's already done a pinnacle of accomplishments. You know, somebody said, who's the greatest mountaineer ever? And somebody else answered, it's Messner, because he's still alive. Not for what he accomplished, but actually it's an and, what he accomplished and being alive. So when I think about my career, I've been on 37 major expeditions, you know, seven summits, Colorado 14ers, Everest, K2, Manaslu, Broad Peak, Shishapangma. Oh my gosh, Choil U. I could easily quit here. But, you know, 2 years ago, I was on this little walk up 11,000 foot peak over here by Estes Park. I was training for Dalagari. I was with my great buddy, Jim Davidson. And we went up on a windy day on purpose to train because, you know, you train, you know, I'm sure in football, you train when the weather is horrible because you might have to play in horrible weather.
Yep.
Same thing for, you know, make sure you can do your gloves and everything in high winds. We got above tree line, only about 100 yards above tree line in a 100-mile-an-hour wind gust knocked me into a scree field, broke my tibia, fibia, smashed my face, laid in there in the rocks for 4 hours until search and rescue came. But laying in the rocks that day, I made a bunch of decisions. You know, one is that I'm not going to let that event define me. I'm not going to be a martyr. I'm going to find the positive in it. I made the choice to exit a few relationships with friends and closer people that were toxic to me. And, you know, it became an inflection point in my life, and I was comfortable never to climb again. But also, as just as I was going under the surgery, I looked up at my orthopedic surgeon, and I said, Dr. Hale, I know I'm 60 years old, but my objective is not to walk from the couch to the chair. My objective is to climb again. And he goes, okay, let's do it. And that's the last thing I remember. Then they put me under. And 18 months later, I summited Island Peak at 20,000 feet in Nepal. And in January of this year, I went down to Ecuador and summited Cotopaxi and Chimborazo and a couple others. And I'm just signed the contract today to go down to Bolivia and some 21,000 foot mountains in Bolivia.
Awesome.
So, Mark, I don't know if I'll ever go back to another 8,000 meter mountain because old and bold. And as they say, your parents get smarter as you get older. Well, you know, I think I'm kind of on that same continuum. And I don't want to be greedy. I'm incredibly grateful for what I have. And I have a platform, I have a voice, and I have an opportunity to influence a generation. And me just going and bagging another big peak is not going to serve that particular mission at this time in my life.
Love that. Love that. I mean, I think we all have to have goals and aspirations. And you know, it really circles back to that question that you ask all these other people in your consulting business is why. And that's, I guess, what I just asked you, and you gave a great answer. And, it ties back into some of the different foundations that you were trying to raise money for. So anyways, listen, it's been great having you on the pod. You're a wealth of information, fascinating. You've been really fortunate in the way that you're climbing career has played out for you. And, you know, then the net is what you just said is you've been able to turn around and inspire so many in terms of pushing them into the mountains or doing things that they didn't think were possible and getting beyond what their barriers were. So, you know, to that, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun just talking with you. I just love having a conversation. It's great.
Well, so tell me where people can find you.
Yeah. Easiest thing is just my website. It's my name, Alan Arnett, ALANARNETTE.com. And that's got links to the blog and the Summit Coach. And it's seriously, it's a website of too much information. So
well, too much information is always good. So, knowledge is power. That's the bottom line.
I like it, my friend.
All right. He is Alan Arnett. Thank you so much.
Best of luck on Everest next year.
Thank you, buddy.
Hey, thank you so much for dropping in and listening to another amazing episode of Finding Your Summit. Truly incredible people doing spectacular things in life, and I hope you were inspired just like I continue to be. Look, I am super grateful that you came in and subscribed to this pod and would be more than appreciative if you gave the show a ratings and review on iTunes. Trust me, it matters. And then also go share it with your friends, of course. Okay, until next week, go do something great, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion. Bye. Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there, because as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.